It's 4 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Ray Kugel reporting. Two rescued in Nepal quake aftermath. Rescue workers pulling two survivors Thursday from the rubble of last week's devastating quake. Rare moments of joy as the death tolls climbed to almost 6,000. Cheers rang out in Nepal's capital of Kathmandu as rescuers pulled out a 15-year-old boy from a demolished guest house. Hours later, a hotel kitchen worker, a woman in her 30s, was also pulled to safety. Teams of rescue workers from across the world continue digging through rubble and aid groups working to get much-needed supplies to the survivors. The UN humanitarian chief, Ellery Amos, is in Nepal for a 3-day visit to assess relief operations. U.S. health officials are shutting down a treatment unit they set up in Liberia at the height of the Ebola crisis last year. That country is now preparing to be declared free of the deadly virus. Liberia has gone 32 days without a new Ebola case. If it stays that way until May 9th, the World Health Organization likely will declare the country Ebola-free. The WHO says the virus has killed more than 10,000 people, mostly in the West African nations of Liberia, Guinea, and Sierra Leone. The Nigerian army says it freed another 150 people who were being held captive by the militant group Boko Haram. An army spokesman told VOA that troops rescued about 100 children and 50 women on Wednesday as they fought their way through the Sambisa forest in northeastern Nigeria. The army claims a day earlier it freed 293 girls and women from the forest. But reporters have yet to see the former captives, and the Nigerian military has yet to release any photographs of them. This is VOA News. Protesters held another large but peaceful march through downtown Baltimore, Maryland, Thursday, as speculation grows about the findings of a police report on the death of Freddie Gray. The 25-year-old African-American man died April 19th from a severe spinal injury while in police custody. His death sparked riots in black neighborhoods in the eastern U.S. city. Police turned over the results of their investigation to the state attorney's office, which will decide whether to charge the 6 officers involved in Gray's arrest. U.S. criminal justice analyst Todd Cox of the liberal advocacy group Center for American Progress says a review of what happened should also consider public reaction.
They need to ensure that whatever the report says, whatever comes out, they will take it seriously and will take whatever actions are necessary to, number one, bring justice to this particular matter, but number two, ensure that whatever reforms need to take place so that these kinds of things don't happen again.
Baltimore authorities have not announced any timetable for the decision on the fate of the 6 officers, all of whom have been suspended with pay. The city has generally been calm since Monday night's violence. German police say they have foiled an alleged Islamic extremist terror attack on a popular May Day bicycle race planned for today. Police in Frankfurt arrested a Turkish-German man and his Turkish wife. Authorities raided the couple's home and found a stash of weapons and bomb-making ingredients. NATO military chief U.S. General Philip Breedlove says the alliance needs better military intelligence on the ground in eastern Ukraine, where he says Russian forces appear to be fortifying military gains despite a 2-month ceasefire. General Breedlove appeared before the U.S. Senate Armed Services Committee in Washington Thursday.
We cannot fully be certain what Russia will do next, and we cannot fully grasp Putin's intent. What we can and are doing is learning from his actions. And what we see suggests growing Russian capabilities, significant military modernization, and ambitious strategic intent.
General Breedlove accused Moscow of supplying pro-Russian rebels in Ukraine's east with heavy weapons and training. U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders of the northeastern state of Vermont announced he'll seek the 2016 Democratic presidential nomination. The 73-year-old self-described socialist is a registered independent, but has been part of the Senate Democratic Caucus since first elected in 2006. He's considered a long shot against former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, the only other declared candidate for the 2016 Democratic nomination. And U.S. jobless claims fell to a 15-year low last week. Economists say such numbers are indicative of an improving job market. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Batty in Washington. Today is Friday, May 1st. And here are some of the stories we are covering. Burundi's main opposition leader calls on President Nkurunziza to drop his decision to seek a third term.
I think that what is to be dealt with first is how does Peter Nkurunziza set aside or give up his ambition of running for a third term.
Agathon Rwasa is leader of Burundi's largest opposition group. A senior U.S. diplomat says Burundi risks boiling over if President Nkurunziza continues to restrict political opposition. A VOA panel discussion focuses on South Sudan's peace process, and some Zimbabweans file a lawsuit to compel the South African government to take action against xenophobia.
We are asking that the President Zuma declare a state of emergency in South Africa, only in the areas that have been affected by xenophobia. Secondly, we are asking the President of South Africa to compel the police commissioner to investigate all reported cases of xenophobia.
That's Washington Melo Makulu of Black Business Forum of Zimbabwe. Nigeria's transitional teams disagree over handover process. And the Red Cross returns burial responsibility to Liberia's Ministry of Health. The Story Plus, Mark Omar's sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Burundi's main opposition leader says Burundians will not allow President Pierre Nkurunziza to tamper with the constitution for the purpose of satisfying his own selfish ambition. There's been five straight days of protest since Mr. Nkurunziza and his ruling CNDD and FDD party decided he should seek a third term, a move the opposition says violates the 2005 Arusha Agreement, which limits the president to two terms. The Burundian Red Cross said 15 protesters were injured during clashes with police on Thursday. Late in the day, a soldier was reportedly killed by an unknown gunman. Agathon Rwasa, head of Burundi's largest opposition, says there can be no democratic election if President Nkurunziza continues to disregard the constitution and the Arusha Accord.
From last Saturday, CNDD-FDD and President Nkurunziza have operated a coup against the constitution. And one knows that in a democratic election, you must first respect the law. And once this constitution of ours and the Arusha Agreement are just wiped away by the selfish intentions of President Nkurunziza and his political party. So I think that what is to be dealt with first is how does Peter Nkurunziza set aside or give up his ambition of running for a third term.
Does that mean that if he continues with his willingness to stand again, you will be boycotting the elections?
It won't be a boycott. I think there is a protestation from the population. I think that the safeguard of the constitution must prevail on everything else.
Mr. Agathon Rwasa, we understand that though you support the ongoing demonstrations, you haven't come out straight to say that you're willing to be part of those demonstrations or you're calling upon your followers to be part of the demonstrations. Has that position changed?
My position is that I support those who are for the respect of the constitution and the agreement of Arusha. The one who called for demonstration called anybody who is understanding that situation in this way. So I think whoever is intended to join with them has the right to do so. And all what I have been saying is just what I repeat. One must be respected to enjoy his rights as a citizen of Burundi. And that's the police must be discouraged in his way of suppressing people against their rights. Utilizing the Imbonerakure against the population, against the demonstrators, is something which is wrong, which is anti-constitutional. So what we ask the President of the Republic and his political parties in the day of the day is just to come to the reason and let people enjoy their rights. And moreover, Nkurunziza must set aside and give up his temptation for a third term so as to boost the security and stability in this country.
Mr. Agathon Rwasa, April 30th is the day that presidential contestants should be presenting their credentials to the National Electoral Commission. Are you ready to submit your candidature?
I would be ready if the constitution is guaranteed. But once this constitution is despised and spurned by Nkurunziza and his camp, I think there is no room for democratic election.
Agathon Rwasa is leader of the former Burundian Rebel National Liberation Front and now head of the largest opposition. He was speaking with Edward Rima of VOA's Central Africa Service. A senior U.S. diplomat has told Burundian President Pierre Nkurunziza that his country risks boiling over if he continues to restrict political opposition. Tom Malinowski, U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for Democracy, Human Rights and Labor, Wednesday met with President Nkurunziza Thursday, soon after arriving in Burundi. He said he urged the president to allow peaceful criticism and room for political opposition before the scheduled June 26 vote.
The position of the United States on the issue of a third term is one that I think is clear to all of you. We have made it known publicly many times before, and I reiterated it to President Nkurunziza when we met this morning. Now, he has also made his position clear, and so the question now is what will happen now in the next few days, in the next few weeks. Our view is that there is still time for dialogue and still room for compromise. But that goal is not advanced when radio stations are shut down, when civil society activists are arrested, when there is intimidation against political opposition. Now, the opposition also needs to refrain from violence and intimidation, and that's something that we have made clear to them in the past and in meetings today. But as I said to members of the government today, it is not insurrection to peacefully demonstrate one's opposition to decisions that the president has made. We also made clear our very strong concern today about the use and arming of the Imbonerakure to intimidate opposition and civil society. Now, again, it is our very strong conviction that it is still not too late to resolve these problems and to move forward on a path of dialogue and democracy.
Tom Malinowski is U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for Democracy, Human Rights and Labor. He spoke to reporters Thursday soon after meeting with Burundian President Pierre Nkurunziza and opposition groups in the capital, Bujumbura. Nigeria's All Progressives Congress, APC party, says officials who, with outgoing President Goodluck Jonathan's administration, are frustrating the transitional process ahead of President-elect General Muhammadu Buhari's official swearing-in. General Buhari is tentatively scheduled to take the oath of office on May 29th. APC spokesman Lyle Mohammed said Thursday President Jonathan's transitional team is now fully cooperating with the APC team to ensure a smooth handover, despite Mr. Jonathan's public pronouncements to do so.
When our transition committee was set up, we liaised and we worked with the arrowhead of the outgoing, government transition. Our understanding then was that the two groups will meet together and work together. And as a matter of fact, we were assured that handing over documents will be issued to us, and we would examine them and we would, ask for clarifications. And we were quite surprised to see that the federal government would not even be ready to hand over the documents to us, and they asked us to wait for as late as the 14th of May, which would leave us with barely 2 weeks to be handing over. So we see their statement yesterday as a small screen. They are not, making things easy for us.
Well, some members of the transitional team have said that it appears members of the APC transitional team are trying to harass and intimidate them. How do you respond to some criticism?
But I don't understand. What do you mean by intimidation and harassment? And we have not even issued a statement so far. So far, the transfer committee has not issued one single statement. All we did yesterday was that we published the names of the members that were inaugurated and the terms of reference. So how can anybody start talking about intimidation or talking about harassment? And you see, we are sick and tired of this argument that because the president, you know, conceded the defeat, therefore, we cannot even criticize the government again. All kinds of appointments have been made at the quick light of this administration, appointments that are bound to tie the hands of the incoming administration. Yet when we raise these issues, they say, oh, we should be grateful that the president, you know, considered as if that concession speech is enough to wipe off all sins. We refuse to be intimidated by them or blackmailed by them.
They are saying that some of the demands are unreasonable, raised in your terms of reference, and it appears the transitional team from the APC is in a haste. I want to get rid of the government.
I think they are just paranoid, absolutely paranoid, because I do not see anything in terms of reference that even suggests that they are in a hurry to take over. So they have simply been paranoid, like we say, it's a misplaced aggression. Probably it's just dawning on them now that they are an outgoing government, because we do not see anything we have said or anything that has been published that even suggests any intimidation or any hurry on our part.
Lau Mohammed is spokesman for Nigeria's All Progressive Congress Party. He spoke with reporter Peter Clotty from the capital, Abuja. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, the first day of May, and please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 17 minutes past the hour. The World Health Organization is set to declare Liberia Ebola-free. It will make that declaration on May 9th if no new cases are reported. In a sign of how the situation has improved, the Liberian Red Cross has handed back responsibility for safe burials to the Ministry of Health, VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
The Red Cross became the lead agency for what it calls safe and dignified burials in Monserrato County in July of last year. The county includes the capital, Monrovia. The agency assumed responsibility at the request of the Liberian Ministry of Health and Social Welfare. In Monrovia, Anita Dullard is the spokesperson for the International Federation of the Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies. She says traditional burials during a time of Ebola can be very dangerous.
Unfortunately, the dead bodies of Ebola victims are actually almost at the most contagious and remain so for up to 10 days after the person has deceased. So washing of the bodies or open casket and contact with the bodies. The difficulty with Ebola, of course, is that it spreads by bodily fluid and contact with the person who has died. And at this hugely contagious stage of the virus in those bodies, it was an absolute disaster for families to be exposing themselves in that way during a traditional burial.
The decision dramatically affected a way of life for saying goodbye to the dead.
This is a huge, huge cultural change for Liberians because it meant not only have they just lost one of their loved ones, they're also suddenly being told that they can't perform the regular rituals that they have to honour their dead, which was, of course, completely traumatic, as I'm sure anyone who's lost a loved one can imagine.
The Red Cross trained 150 volunteers, and from last July to April of this year, safely buried more than 3,500 bodies. Dullard doubts Liberia would be on the verge of being Ebola-free unless burial protocols were strictly enforced.
Prevention, obviously, is paramount, and getting those messages out there about how not to contract the disease. But in a final wash-up, contact with people who have the disease is ultimately how the disease spreads so rapidly. And if we hadn't had safe and dignified burials, you know, I think we'd be facing a very different situation now.
The Red Cross will continue other Ebola-related programs in Liberia, including emotional and psychosocial support, strengthening health systems, and cross-border surveillance to ensure Ebola-infected individuals do not enter from Guinea and Sierra Leone. There have been more than 10,000 suspected, probable, and confirmed cases of Ebola in Liberia, and more than 4,600 deaths. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
South Sudan's ambassador to the United States says ending the more than a year-long civil war and bringing peace to the people is the number one priority of the government of President Salva Kiir. But peace has eluded the country since fighting broke out in December 2013 between government forces and rebels loyal to former Vice President Riek Machar. Negotiations led by the regional group IGA have failed to end the conflict. Speaking Thursday on the peace process in South Sudan during a panel discussion here at the Voice of America studio in Washington, Ambassador Garang Dink Akuon said South Sudan needs permanent peace to actualize the country's independence.
To bring peace in South Sudan needs a resolve from both parties, the government and the rebels. Peace is essential for South Sudanese people because we need peace. The independence we won was because we needed a permanent peace. It is unfortunate that we have this incident and we are now going through this war. So a peaceful settlement is the goal of the international community, the hope of people of South Sudan, and the government has committed itself, and the president has been more than committed, and he met the rebel leader more than once, so that peace can be reached in our country. All of us are yearning for peace, especially the government, because it is the government that is responsible for protection of the integrity and sovereignty of the country. Therefore, it is the government that needs peace more than anybody else.
Garang Dink Akuon is the South Sudan ambassador to Washington. He spoke Thursday during a panel discussion on the South Sudan peace process here at the Voice of America. Also speaking during the panel discussion was former U.S. ambassador to South Sudan, Susan Page, who is currently senior advisor to the office of the U.S. Special Envoy for Sudan and South Sudan. She expressed disappointment that the warring parties have not been able to achieve peace despite enormous international goodwill in facilitating the talks. Ambassador Page said one essential element to peace is compromise.
Not very happy to be talking about the sad situation in South Sudan, as all of us are very saddened by what's going on and disappointed. But in terms of the peace process, we have consistently been saying that it is imperative that the peace process be broad-based, that a wide variety of people representing all walks of life. We also think that one of the essential elements is compromise. That's true in any negotiation. The parties have agreed to create a transitional government, and that's what we have been pushing for, along with the broad-based participation of people from all walks of Sudanese life. So these are some of the areas that we believe are very critical. And the one thing that hasn't yet been highlighted since we just began is the necessity for accountability and justice and reconciliation. We believe that that is really imperative to ending the cycle of violence that has gone on for a very long time in South Sudan.
That was Susan Page, former U.S. ambassador to South Sudan. Also speaking during the panel discussion was South Sudan civil society activist Cyril Cleto Rial. She said the peace process needs to be more inclusive.
December 13 brought to light the hegemony of the few and the victimization of many. And it became like a groups, people with their tribes, and mainly it's the two major tribes that has been fighting. And even if we look at the table is not inclusive. And when we look at the negotiations now, it's trying just to end the war. But what next after that? And it became a discussion among the two individuals. It's more personalized, or it's just the groups, the government and the SPLM, or in opposition. We understand that there are women in all the delegation, but when we look at this small table, there's no gender balance.
That was South Sudan civil society activist Cyril Cleto Rial speaking Thursday during a panel discussion on South Sudan's peace process here at the Voice of America studio. The Black Business Forum Zimbabwe and the Zimbabwe Exiles Forum have filed a lawsuit compelling South African President Jacob Zuma's administration to declare a state of emergency in xenophobic hotspots in line with the country's State of Emergency Act of 1997.
We are basically asking the South African government to implement what they have undertaken to do in a legal way. Remember, following the xenophobic attack, the South African government has made certain undertakings. And we are simply saying these things must be codified in law. The main argument that we are making is that, firstly, we are asking that the President Zuma declare a state of emergency in South Africa, only in the areas that have been affected by xenophobia. Secondly, we are asking the President of South Africa to compel the police commissioner to investigate all reported cases of xenophobia. We are also asking the President to compel the Director of Public Prosecution to prosecute all cases that have been brought by police with respect to xenophobia. In our application, we have also cited the Speaker of Parliament of South Africa, and we are asking the court to order the Speaker of Parliament that within 1 year from the date of this application, South Africa comes with an anti-xenophobia law.
But is this not a legal overreach, Mr. Mehlomakulu, in that Mr. Zuma is the president of South Africa, and should he be compelled by foreigners to actually declare state of emergency in South Africa?
Remember, our co-applicant is actually a South African institution. The Zimbabwe Exiles Forum is a South African institution. And in fact, we do have local standing. In other words, we have got legal standing to approach the South African courts for protection. Recall, this is not the first time. If you remember, Zimbabwean farmers have actually gone to South African courts seeking redress on matters that actually took place in Zimbabwe. And we believe that we have the legal standing to approach a court to seeking protection of foreign nationals that are in South Africa.
Washington, Mehlomakulu is Secretary for Economic Affairs in the Black Business Forum, Zimbabwe. He was speaking to viewers. Blessing Zulu. Time now for Daybreak Africa's person. Here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Friday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa sports news, we begin with athletics. Botswana, Egypt, Kenya, Namibia, and Nigeria are among 44 nations whose athletes have converged in Nassau in the Bahamas for the second edition of the IAAF BTC World Relays starting tomorrow, Saturday. Teams are vying for medals in men's and women's 4x100 meters, 4x200 meters, 4x400 meters, 4x800 meters, and a medley relay consisting of athletes running 1200 meters, 400 meters, 800 meters, and 1600 meters. Besides the total cash prize of $1.4 million that is up for grabs, teams will be seeking to strengthen their chances of qualifying for the 4x100 meters and 4x400 meter relays for the IAAF World Athletics Championships due in Beijing, China, in August. Meanwhile, South Africa's World Student Games Half Marathon champion Gladwin Mzazi is delighted after clocking 27 minutes and 56.7 seconds in 10,000 meters at the recent University Sports South Africa Athletics Championships. He says it's a fitting reflection of their preparations for the season.
We've been training so hard to qualify for the World Champs and the Olympics for next year. I think our hard work paid off. I was very happy that I managed to run my PB and run under 28 minutes in the 10,000 meters.
Going forward, you're known more for the 5,000 meters. Can we expect a PB from you in 5,000 meters?
I'm hoping to qualify for World Champs. I'm in 13:23. I'll try to do my best. If I can qualify for the World Champs, then I'll be happy, knowing that I'll have to focus on the 5 for this year. Then for next year, go for 10,000 meters at the Olympics. Okay,
yeah. That was South Africa's Gladwin Mzazi, the World Student Games Half Marathon Champion, speaking in Stellenbosch, South Africa. Turning to football, Ghana aimed to at least reach the semifinals at the FIFA Under-20 World Cup due to kick off in New Zealand at the end of this month. The Ghana coach, Selous Tete, told the Accra media on Thursday. Tete previously guided Ghana to win this age group tournament in 2009 in Egypt and to clinch a bronze medal in 2013 in Turkey. Ghana faced Argentina, Austria, and Panama in their Group B preliminary. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa, wishing you all a sporty weekend. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Monk. Have a good weekend. And that's it for this Friday, May 1st edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing all of you a very good weekend.
Next on Let's Talk, join host Sunday Shomari and his guests discussing language influences. This lighthearted show covers topics of your interest with some hilarity. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.